From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we start the hour in Hawaii. The U.S. Geological Survey has upgraded its warning on the Kilauea volcano eruption to red, meaning an eruption with significant ash emission is likely imminent. The volcano has been opening up fissures since May 3rd. One person who has seen that volcano up close is self-described lava chaser Demian Barrios. He's a photographer and has been watching Hawaii's volcanoes for years. We reached him yesterday on Skype just as the volcano activity was kicking up. This volcano has actually been erupting for years, but Demian told us this time is different.
It is. So, you know, this is these fissure eruptions are a lot more random. They're not as predictable. And it's, you know, I have all the respect and a lot of sentiment for the people who have lost homes and been displaced. But, you know, having said that, it has been a very exciting time. We haven't had an eruption like this since 1955. So it's very historical, very different. And, you know, from that standpoint, it's been pretty exciting to watch.
And this is all happening in one area of the Big Island. I've heard less than 5% of the Big Island of Hawaii has been affected by this. But are you worried about, was that a lava eruption that we're hearing
that
in the background?
That was a lava eruption. Wow. That you can hear in the background, yes.
Well, are you worried about wow, that's pretty amazing. Tell us what's happening.
So we have a part of the fissure 18 over here that has a pretty active vent. It is putting a lot of superheated steam and gas, or not steam, just gas coming out. And it is ejecting some lava bombs into the air. So those are the explosions that you are hearing. I'm about 3/4 of a mile from that site.
It's pretty loud, even 3/4 of a mile away.
It is very loud, definitely louder than a jet engine. And, you know, there's a couple points where I was even putting earplugs in my ear because we were so close and it was so loud.
Hmm. So there are other vents. This is just amazing to listen to. I mean, you know what it sounds like to me just from this distance, and maybe to some of our listeners, it sounds like a whale sending water out of its blowhole.
Yeah. So imagine a whale, but instead of sending water, it's, you know, hot rocks and hot volcanic vapor.
Yeah, much more dangerous. One of the big warning signs for people there has been that there have been earthquakes that happen before the eruptions. Is that still the case, or now do you kind of never know when it's going to start to spew lava?
You know, it really has been unpredictable. But yes, for the most part, there has been indications prior to that, knowing that there's going to be something happen. There's normally a crack that opens up and lots of gases starting to come out. And normally we have felt a huge earthquake right before a huge fissure eruption has erupted. So a lot of times we've been sitting here at ground zero and at a current place, and then we see some smoke and some cracks happening, and then we feel a huge shake in the ground, and we'll look up and we'll see that right at that instant, a new fissure has popped up.
And what we just heard behind you while you were talking there sounded more like gunshots.
Yes. So, you know, there are some, that one that's producing those sounds is actually not producing a lot of lava. Some of the other fissures next to that are not as loud, and they're the ones that are actually shooting a lot more lava out. That one seems to be getting clogged with any lava that's on the surface, and that's what's trapping in those gases. Once it builds enough pressure, that's when it's releasing, and that's when we're hearing those loud explosions and also sending out some, you know, superheated lava bombs that have been kind of exciting to watch, you know, rocks flying hundreds of feet in the air.
So do you think a bigger eruption is yet to come?
You know, it's very possible. This eruption has been following almost verbatim to what the 1955 eruption did. And as much as the community would like to see things calm down here, it is very likely, and geologists and experts have been saying that it is very likely that we might see a larger eruption, not just these fissure eruptions. So it's a very good chance that, you know, a large part of this fault line could open up, giving way to a massive erupting cinder cone. But, you know, we're kind of keeping our fingers crossed. As exciting as it would be to see that, you know, it's also going to have a huge impact here on the community and the residents. So I'm kind of hoping it doesn't come to that. And, you know, maybe life can go back to normal here on the island.
I wonder if you could just let us listen for 30 seconds to the sound of this volcano.
Absolutely. I'll just hold the mic out here and let me know when you're ready.
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
Wow. And what are you seeing as we're listening to that?
So there is a big amount of smoke that comes out. So because of my distance, there's a little bit of lag between the audio and what I'm actually seeing. So you see a huge plume of smoke. You see huge rocks fly up into the air. And then you can hear those explosions. So there's a combination of the explosion and then also the venting of the gas that makes that jet engine sound.
Well, Demian, I had no idea that when we did this interview that we would be doing it right in the middle of an eruption like that. But it's really exciting to hear. I hope you're staying safe during all of this. And thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me today, guys. And stay safe out there.
Photographer and lava chaser Demian Barrios. Will link you to some of his videos and photos at hereandnow.org.
Jeremy, that was amazing. Lava bombs and whale blowholes.
Well, it's the kind of thing where you just wish you had a whole hour to talk to him and listen to that.
Well, I can't promise this next story is going to be as exciting, but we'll try. In Washington, the House is expected to vote this week on the 2018 Farm Bill. And it's unclear whether Republicans have enough votes to pass it. One point of contention is the work requirement for recipients of SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. SNAP is vital for low-income families, including immigrants. But if parents aren't living legally in the United States, they may decide not to enroll their children who are American citizens. Esther Honig of Harvest Public Media reports from Colorado.
In the small city of Fort Morgan, Colorado, 33-year-old Veronica delicately stacks cans of food into her shopping cart at the local food pantry. She says this pantry has a lot of options and helps her keep food on the table.
Leche, huevos, también llevo frutas, verduras.
Her cart is piled high with milk, eggs, fruits, and vegetables. Enough food to last about a week. Veronica asked not to be identified by her full name due to the sensitive nature of this topic. SNAP, also known as food stamps, helps her feed her five young children, though it's not always enough. That's why today she's at this pantry called Rising Up. Food pantries may become increasingly important to immigrant communities across the country. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says about 4 million children who are citizens but whose parents are unauthorized immigrants receive SNAP benefits. The children are eligible if their household income is at or below 130% of the federal poverty guidelines, or about $2,600 a month for a family of four. Yet, advocates say families with unauthorized immigrants are wary to share information with a government agency in order to enroll in SNAP.
Hola, mi nombre es Anya. Gracias por llamar a Colorado Sin Hambre. ¿Cómo le puedo ayudar?
Anya Rose helps run Hunger Free Colorado's food resource hotline. She talks with unauthorized immigrants every day.
I think that we are seeing more people afraid to apply for food stamps or deciding not to recertify or ending their benefits, even though they might be eligible.
Rose says the Trump administration, which supports policies targeting unauthorized immigrants, has stoked fear among families. They worry their personal information could be shared with other government agencies like ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Rose tells them their SNAP application is confidential and that these benefits will ensure they don't go hungry. But some families won't risk it.
They might say, I hear you, but I'm just not going to engage with this. It doesn't make sense for me or my family.
In the meantime, Rose refers them to local food pantries like Rising Up.
Lots of times we see people that are just trying to get started and to get by. And so that's where we try to help them.
Pam Hernandez is the director and says the pantry serves 300 families a year. Many come to Fort Morgan to work at factories like the Cargill meatpacking plant. She says the majority of people who come in are also on SNAP. And although the clients are asked for proof of local residence, she's not worried whether they're authorized to live in the U.S.
The thing is, if you're hungry, we're here to help you.
After 49-year-old Aurelia lost her job in January, she started shopping at the pantry. She's also on SNAP and volunteers here to satisfy some of the program's work requirements. She asked that her full name not be used because she has relatives who are unauthorized immigrants. Aurelia knows of many families who would rather go hungry than risk signing up for SNAP. Like many pantries, Rising Up doesn't track how many clients are unauthorized immigrants. Pam Hernandez suspects they don't get very many, but...
You know, we always make make it a point to let people know that it's not all about the paperwork.
She's confident that if families need help, they'll feel safe coming here. Aurelia has lived in this community for 22 years and says the unauthorized immigrant population has feared deportation before, like during the raid at a dairy here 7 years ago. But Aurelia says she and other immigrants came here to work, and they're not going anywhere. For Here and Now, I'm Esther Honig.
And Esther's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting project that focuses on farm and food issues. On Twitter this morning, President Trump congratulated the two Republican Senate candidates he backed who won primaries in Pennsylvania and Nebraska last night. And Democrats also found something to cheer about from that election in Pennsylvania, which right now has an all-male congressional delegation. At least seven women candidates won their primaries, and three of them stand a pretty good chance of winning seats for the Democrats in November.
And in Washington today, CIA Director nominee Gina Haspel won a key confirmation vote in committee with the help of a Democrat. Our political strategists join us, Paris Denard, Republican strategist and member of a Trump Advisory Commission. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
And Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. And what's your take on the primaries yesterday? Do they say anything to you, Jamal, about the direction of the party heading into the midterms this fall?
Well, I take I think it was a good day for Democrats. We've got, as you said, there are seven women who won some of those Democratic primaries. I think the energy behind women candidates is especially strong. We've seen it from the week after, or day after the president's inauguration. We also have a candidate who beat the Democratic Party establishment, which I think is also good and healthy, because last thing you want are a bunch of people sitting around Washington and picking candidates out in the rest of the country. And I'm glad the country speaks up and says, no, we want somebody who we think is going to best represent us. That's
but
very healthy.
The candidates, for the most part, are more liberal, right? The liberals did well, better than the moderates last night.
Well, you know, I think that we're in an era where people have been pushed into their corners, the candidates that are going to do the best are the ones that can activate their base, get their base motivated to get out, and then have an appeal that reaches across to the middle a little bit. But let's not start at the middle and then try to sell to the base. Let's start at the base and then sell to the middle.
Paris, what about you? How are Republicans feeling today? Several Trump supporters did win, but not all of them. Congressman Raul Labrador, an immigration hardliner, lost his gubernatorial primary in Idaho.
That's right. I think we have to look at bright spots like Pennsylvania. I think when you look at the fact that the GOP there saw, I think it was like 200,000 or 82% turnout increase compared to primary voters in 2014, and then the Democrats seeing turnout decrease by 8% compared to 2014. That tells us that Republicans are motivated, excited, and wanting to come out and support and vote for our candidates. And we have some good candidates, especially in Pennsylvania. And I think that these progressive Democrats, these more liberal Democrats, are going to have a difficult time building and drawing a more broad coalition. What they're going to need to do in November to get those independent-minded voters, those voters who are looking to the Trump agenda and say, you know what, there's some things I may not like that he says, but my goodness, when it looks at the economy and what he's doing in international front related to North Korea, I think we're on the right track, because the majority of Americans feel that we're on the right track about certain things. So I think that, you know, they're going to have a problem there. But from the Republican side, especially looking at Pennsylvania, energy is up and voter participation, GOTV is up, and that's a good thing.
Jamal, do you agree that Republicans have more energy in Pennsylvania than the Democrats do?
Yet to be seen. Here's what I think. Sometimes we like to couch all these campaigns in sort of left-right paradigm. And I did it a little bit in my earlier comment. But sometimes these aren't left-right fights. Sometimes these are up-down fights, right? Sometimes it's about the people who are out trying to fight the people who are in. And I think Trump was very good when he ran with putting himself on the side of the people who felt left out in America. And I think Democrats have finding their voice to get on that same side. And we're going to make some arguments about not just these causes like, you know, Me Too and Black Lives Matter and immigration, but also about economic aspiration and helping people get better jobs and make more money, which is what most people in the country want.
Well, some Democrats took part yesterday in an audition of sorts for 2020 at the Center for American Progress Ideas Conference. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren had a strong anti-Trump message. The former Obama Housing Secretary, Julian Castro, was there. Here's what he told C-SPAN this week about a presidential run.
I haven't made a decision yet, but I'm going to do that before the end of the year.
What compelled you to at least think about it?
What we can see here in Washington, D.C. is a vacuum of leadership. This president is taking the country in the wrong direction. And I have always had a positive vision for the future of my community and of the country. And that's why I'm thinking about it.
Paris, let me start with you. And you have to be totally honest with me. Are you worried about any Democrats that could face President Trump in 2020 at this point? Or who are you most worried about?
I'm not worried about anybody right now,
really?
Because I think that they have so many people who are trying to vie for the nomination of Castro, Warner, Biden, Harris, and it goes on and on. I mean, so I think that the Democrats need to coalesce around somebody who they think can really challenge this Make America Great agenda and the positive direction that we're taking this country, both domestically and internationally. So I think that whomever they pick is going to have to be someone who is strong enough to go against this president's agenda, which has been very positive for putting America first.
Jamal, is that right? I mean, it is very early in the process, but we are starting to see some of these names come out, Democrats jockeying for position. I mean, what are you making of all that?
Oh, I think we have an embarrassment of riches on the Democratic side.
And does that hurt you?
No, because we're going to have a big, ugly, messy primary fight, and we're going to hash it all out, and we're going to figure out, you know, what kind of candidate we want. We've got these great people. Castro may run, Elizabeth Warren, Harris, Booker. But then we've got these mayors who are out there, like Garcetti from L.A. and Mitch Landrieu from New Orleans, who are really doing some very interesting things. They're not all going to be – I would probably bet that the candidate for the Democratic Party is not somebody who currently has a job in Washington, D.C.
Well, I think a long, bloody, you know, embarrassing Democrat fight
on,
for
right?
the
you
left
Paris,
is very
right?
good for President Trump. As he continues to raise money, the RNC gets the infrastructure growing. I think that's going to be great.
Okay, Paris, it's
been
a week.
Hold on one second. I've heard also that Trump may get a primary challenge, and you may see President Trump have to fight off a Ben Sasse or the governor of Ohio, who may also run.
If he fought off 16, he can handle those two.
One-on-one, I don't know.
So we have plenty of time to talk about 2020, but in the present right
it's
now.
It's so much fun, though. It's so much fun.
No, let's move on, please.
It has been a week, Paris, since a White House aide made disparaging remarks about John McCain, the senator who's seriously ill right now. This morning, the White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the leakers of the story should be fired, not the employee who made them. Do you defend Trump's handling of this? Many people have said that this is sort of a message coming down from the top. Trump has made remarks about McCain, and so the employees feel like they can too.
No, look, I know Kelly Sattler personally. I know the McCain family very well and have known them for decades personally. Look, I think Kelly Sattler made an inarticulate, insensitive, flippant comment in a private meeting talking about communication strategy relating to our CIA director, the nominee. And she called Meghan McCain and other people in the family, close to the family, and apologized immediately, which is the thing that she should have done.
But not
and
publicly.
She
called just Meghan McCain and apologized.
Right. And I listen, that's the right thing to do. If somebody offends you, you call them, pick up the phone and apologize to them directly. And so this has nothing to do. We're trying to make this into something bigger than the president or the White House. The right thing was done. She apologized directly to the family, to other sources. Case closed. But the issue about these leakers is one that is significant because it has plagued a portion of this White House. And it is really causing a chilling effect. It's wrong and it's embarrassing.
I want to ask you about that. I mean, what is really wrong with a leak like this? Anyways, we live in the United States, where we cherish sunshine on our government. This is not a classified secret. It sheds some light on things that are happening within the White House. That seems fair game to me and probably a lot of other Americans.
Sure. If you're a staffer sitting in a meeting and somebody and you work tirelessly every day, all day, 24/7, and you hear something that you think that is inappropriate, especially about Senator John McCain, then you come to that person and say, you know what? I don't think that was right. I don't think that was done. You don't go and try to embarrass that person or get that person fired by leaking it to the press. And I think what you see is when people are leaking, the types of leaks that are happening out of some of these offices in the White House are done to undermine the president, do personal vendettas or agendas, or embarrass the president. And it's not right. And if you want to leak something that's positive, this person's happening, this policy proposal is coming out, that's great. But to do it to undermine is just wrong. And if you don't like the president, you don't like the agenda, self-select and get yourself out of there, or they should be fired.
Jamal, as Paris said there, this was all about the CIA director nominee, Gina Haspel, and the fact that McCain was against her nomination. Today, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, a Democrat, voted for her in committee. What's that about? There are several Democrats who say that they are going to vote for her.
Well, I think there are lots of people who think that she has acquitted herself very well since the time that she was in charge of the torture program. You know, John McCain disagrees and he thinks the torture is wrong and didn't want to. But, you know, other Democrats and Republicans have a right to find the things that they are important. A lot of people are also worried about who else President Trump might appoint. But, you know, like let's just to go back to the previous statement. These are not – in normal times, I would agree with Paris 100%. A president and a government official should be able to have conversations inside their office without having them being leaked. But these are not normal times. President Trump don't say sorry. And he, even when he does things like stand up and equivocate over Nazi sympathizers and alt-right sympathizers, I think people inside that government ought to come forward and say what they think all the time. Let's undermine this president and try to shut this thing down. Hmm. It's not normal.
Well, the problem is if a Democrat happens to win in you know, 10 years or 20 years and gets into the White House, well, let's replay that clip and let's see how he feels about undermining an administration. This is about the presidency, and this is about something bigger than just one individual.
Well,
the person who allegedly said something that was offensive, apologize, and it's case closed. Kelly Sadler apologized, period.
Well, Donald Trump should treat the presidency with more respect and more honor than he does. He lies all the time. He doesn't have any desire to hold the presidency to the mm-hmm. honor that it has had in the past.
Guys, this is a good debate, but I think this is probably a good spot to cut it off. That was Jamal Simmons, a Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, the Republican.
Have a good day.
Thanks to you both, guys. Time is running out to strike a new deal this year on the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mexico's economic minister said yesterday that he does not think there will be a new agreement by Thursday. Now, that's a deadline set by House Speaker Paul Ryan, who says Congress would need a deal by then to vote on it before the midterm elections. On Fox News this morning, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said the U.S. could still pull out of NAFTA.
We still want to see something happen, and we're going to continue in those conversations. They're ongoing now, and we're pushing forward and hopeful that we can get something done soon.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said this week the countries are very close to an agreement. Charisse Jones of USA Today joins us now. Hi, Charisse.
Hello.
Hey, so we're hearing different things from different countries here about whether or not we're going to see a deal this week. What should we believe? What is likely to happen?
Well, it doesn't look too good for this week, but there's still a chance that sometime in June they will come to the table and get something hammered out because there's a lot of dueling time pressures. You know, on June 1st, they're talking about imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum from Mexico and Canada. There's an election in Mexico on mm-hmm. July 1st, and they're worried about that as well. You know, a new leadership coming in. So they want to try and get this done before then. But if they don't do it by July, it's not looking too good for this year.
So those are some reasons for this somewhat arbitrary deadline, but it is also because of politics in the United States. Paul Ryan wants to keep this deal out of the midterm elections. What are his considerations?
Yeah, you know, big business is not crazy about renegotiating NAFTA. And there's, you know, a clause basically that says that the president can get a vote up or down without amendments on a trade pact, but Congress has 90 days before it's signed to do that. And so, you know, if he runs out the clock, then he doesn't have to take on constituents and donors who are not really happy about this agreement being renegotiated.
One of the biggest sticking points, it looks like, as these talks go on and have been going on, is that it's from the auto industry, and they're having these questions about country of origin requirements. What does the U.S. want there?
Yeah, it's getting kind of complicated. I mean, basically, they want if 40% of the car parts have to be made by people who make $16 an hour or more. And that's something that's going to be difficult for Mexico, where the wages are sometimes as low as less than $4. And then Detroit automakers are happy about it because they pay, you know, those wages on the factory floor and to research and development. But foreign car makers who make cars here do more of their R&D overseas, so it may not be as good for them. So there's a lot of friction going on there as well.
From the point of view of the Mexicans, I know they're concerned about something called a sunset provision, which basically means the deal would have to, be renegotiated every 5 years? What are their concerns?
Yeah, they don't want to, you know, make all of these concessions and then you can be back at the table in 5 years and renegotiate the whole thing all over again. And, you know, Mexico has really, you know, prospered with NAFTA, and they want to keep that going. And they're very concerned about an agreement that's going to tilt more towards the U.S. and away from them. So, you know, all of those are concerns.
So just a few seconds left. What do you think the chances are the White House just decides to pull out of the deal?
Well, they might do it, but if they do, it could really be catastrophic. We're talking about the GDP being affected, millions of jobs being lost, so it's an expensive gamble to take.
All right, we're going to keep an eye on it. Charisse Jones of USA Today, thanks very much.
Thank you.
New research published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association finds 1 in 7 adults in the U.S. have tried e-cigarettes or vapes. The study also showed a slight decline in continued use. But overall, the multi-billion-dollar vaping industry continues to grow. We're going to take a broader look now at the health effects and laws associated with e-cigarettes. And joining us is Stanton Glantz, director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at the University of California, San Francisco. Stanton Glantz, welcome. And first, how do e-cigarettes work?
Well, the way a cigarette works is you burn the tobacco to generate an aerosol of ultrafine particles and nicotine, which is the addictive drug in tobacco products, down deep into your lungs where it gets absorbed and then quickly goes to your brain. E-cigarettes generate an aerosol of ultrafine particles by taking a solution of nicotine, propylene glycol, glycerol, flavors, and other things. And it absorbs it into a wick, and then there's a heater coil, kind of like the heaters you see in toasters, wrapped around the wick. That generates the aerosol that people inhale to take the nicotine deep into their lungs.
Are they safer than cigarettes?
E-cigarettes produce lower levels of cancer-causing chemicals than conventional cigarettes do, but just like conventional cigarettes, they help to cause heart disease and heart attacks, lung disease. And in fact, there's growing evidence that in terms of adverse effects on the lung, e-cigarettes are actually worse than conventional cigarettes.
And what about the amount of nicotine that somebody is taking in with an e-cigarette versus a cigarette?
It's very variable. It depends on the level of concentration in the nicotine liquid which you put in the e-cigarettes, and also things like the voltage that the e-cigarette is running at. There's also a new form of e-cigarette called Juul, which instead of dissolving the nicotine in propylene glycol, uses a salt of nicotine. And that gives much higher levels of nicotine.
Well, I want to get to Juul, but first of all, let me just ask you, anecdotally, when I see people now more and more frequently out on the streets with their vapes, when they exhale, it looks like they're breathing out a lot of smoke, or in this case, I guess it's vapor, but it looks like more than you would think with a device like that.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the incorrect things that a lot of people think about e-cigarettes is they're just harmless water vapor. Well, water vapor is clear, and you're breathing out a huge plume of propylene glycol, nicotine, and also because of the coils in the e-cigarettes and the fact that they're soldered, people get a lot of lead, cadmium, and other heavy metals.
How often are people using vapes or e-cigarettes in order to stop smoking cigarettes?
Well, one of the major reasons people use e-cigarettes, especially adults, is because they think they'll help them try to quit. Mm-hmm. For most people, they actually make it harder to quit.
Why is that?
Well, nobody knows for sure, but a couple of reasons people talk about are that a lot of people will use e-cigarettes in places they're not allowed to smoke. People think they're safer, and they think that if they use some e-cigarettes, that they're reducing their risks. And we found that the use of the e-cigarettes and the cigarettes compound, so that if you're using cigarettes and e-cigarettes at the same time, which is what most people do, you actually are at a higher risk of a heart attack.
What about the rules on this? I've read stories about kids in school, you know, going into the bathroom and vaping, or even doing it in the classroom and then breathing out into their shirt.
Yeah, that's called stealth vaping. And products like Juul, which produce a lower volume of aerosol because the nicotine concentration is so much higher, are even easier for people to hide. And it's part of the game and part of the rebellion of using e-cigarettes for kids is that you use them right in class and the teacher doesn't even know it.
Well, you mentioned Juul again. This is a company that now makes up about 60% of the market. Why have they become so popular?
Well, Juul is wildly popular with kids. And unlike conventional cigarettes where youth use them as a way to emulate adults, the e-cigarette epidemic has really grown from the young kids up into the adults. So e-cigarette market penetration in the youth market is way higher. And the Juul is, it's cool. It looks like a flash drive. It's very high tech. You get a huge nicotine hit from it, and it comes in fun flavors.
Well, Juul says that it is targeting people who already smoke. You don't buy that?
No, not at all. I mean, the tobacco companies have said for decades that they don't want kids to smoke, when in fact, if they don't get kids to smoke, then their market dies out. And, you know, Juul says, and other e-cigarette companies, which include the major cigarette companies, all say they don't want kids to use the product. But there's lots of things they could do if they really didn't want kids to use the product. For example, they would stop making them in these kid-friendly flavors.
So as we've said, these products haven't been around for all that long. Do we have enough information about the health effects, the long-term health effects?
Well, we don't know the long-term health effects because we have to wait a long time to know what the long-term health effects are. But we already know that they are very bad for your lungs, that they trigger a lot of inflammatory processes, that they depress your immune processes in your lungs and make it easier to get infected. We know that they turn off normal functioning of arteries the way that conventional cigarettes do. And as I said, we have a research we've done that shows that people who use these cigarettes daily have an almost doubling of their risk of having had a heart attack. And that's on top of the heart attack risks of any cigarette smoking that they're doing. And they're also very, very attractive to kids. About a third of the kids who initiate nicotine use with these cigarettes have psychological profiles that make it, you think it would be very unlikely they would ever pick up a cigarette. But once they start with these cigarettes, a lot of the kids then convert to conventional cigarettes.
So what needs to change? Do there need to be new regulations? Does there need to be an alternative product?
Well, the alternative product that we've developed over the years is simply being a non-smoker.
Right.
And we've made huge progress in denormalizing tobacco use and making the cool thing to do to be a non-smoker.
Well, that's what's
and
so surprising about this, by the way, is that I see that you can't smoke in restaurants and bars anymore. But then I look out on the street and I see so many more people using these vaping devices.
Right. Until e-cigarettes came along, total tobacco and nicotine consumption was dropping.
Right.
And at least with youth, it's now increasing.
So do there need to be new regulations?
Yes. And I think, you know, it was very disappointing because when Obama was still president, the FDA tried to put in place rules severely restricting the use of flavors. And the Obama White House cut those rules out. The FDA under Trump, up until recently, had been really moving very, very slowly to address flavors. But I think the explosion of Juul and flavored tobacco products is really concerning the FDA, and they're at least talking about doing some things. The real action, though, on these things is happening, as most things in tobacco, at this local and state level. For example, here in California and in many other places, you can't use e-cigarettes in places that you can't smoke. Here in San Francisco, the city passed a law prohibiting the sale of any flavored tobacco products, including flavored e-cigarettes. R.J. Reynolds Tobacco spent about $12 million so far forcing a referendum on that law, which will be voted on in the June election.
That's Stanton Glantz, who is director at the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at the University of California, San Francisco. Stanton Glantz, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And we reached out to Juul. In a statement, the company defended its use of flavored nicotine and said it is committed to deterring young people as well as adults who do not currently smoke from using e-cigarettes.
The past few years have been a roller coaster for U.S.-Cuba relations. In 2015, President Obama began to soften a long-standing travel ban, but just 2 years later, the Trump administration clamped back down. Now some marine researchers from Florida are trying a form of science diplomacy. They're working with their Cuban counterparts to study the impact of oil spills in the Caribbean, and what they learn could benefit both countries. Reporter David Levin has the story.
In Old Havana, music spills out of clubs and echoes across the streets as antique cars putter by. Many of them date back to the 1950s, to the Cuban Revolution. It's like the city is stuck in time. But in the waters of the Gulf of Mexico surrounding Cuba, oil companies are looking decidedly to the future. They're drilling wells in deeper and deeper water off the southern U.S. and Yucatan Peninsula. Scientist David Hollander thinks it may be a matter of time before another huge spill devastates the Gulf. And if that happens, Cuba will undoubtedly feel its effects.
In the event of an oil spill, oil doesn't know a northern boundary from a southern boundary or eastern or from a western boundary. There's a lot of connectivity within the regions of the Gulf and among the regions of the Gulf.
Hollander is a geochemist at the University of South Florida. He leads a team of researchers called SeaImage that studies the long-term effects of oil spills in the Gulf. They're trying to figure out the best way to respond to the next big one. And that involves going beyond American shores and looking at how spills damage the Gulf as a whole. The team has already spent more than 6 years doing field work in U.S. waters. They've also partnered with the Mexican government to look at their oceans. But that adds up to only two-thirds of the Gulf.
Cuba was kind of the missing piece. It's a central location where water comes in between the Yucatan Peninsula and the west coast of Cuba, and water goes out between Cuba and Key West. And if you want to talk about the Gulf as an entity, you really have to have some information about Cuba itself.
Steve Morawski runs SeaImage along with Hollander. He says that all the water in the Gulf flows past Cuba at some point, but researchers still don't know much about the deep ocean that surrounds the island. Since the Cuban Revolution, U.S. scientists have been barred from working there, and scientists in Cuba haven't had access to the tools they need to study areas deeper than 200 feet. Just off the Cuban coast, the bottom drops down to more than 1,000 feet, and what happens there can have a huge impact on the rest of the Gulf.
Cuba and South Florida are only separated by 90 miles. If they have an accident, it's going to be in our waters sooner or later. If we have an accident, it's going to be in their waters. So we share this mutual concern for the impacts of a particular catastrophic event.
That sort of mutual interest inspired the SeaImage team to try something radical. They're launching a campaign to reach across political boundaries, and they're starting to work with Cuban scientists directly. After slogging through nearly a year of red tape, they're kicking off a series of research cruises from Havana.
Hi, I'm Ben.
Claudia,
nice to meet you.
In Havana's harbor, Cuban and American scientists meet for the first time on the Weatherbird 2, a U.S. research vessel. They're doing joint fieldwork offshore, along with a group of 18 students from all over Cuba. Together, they'll grab sediment samples from the deep ocean and gather fish living there as well, all to establish a baseline for the health of the region and to tease apart how it might be damaged in an oil spill. Morawski watches the group file onto the deck of the Weatherbird.
A cruise like this hasn't been done in 50 years, and hopefully, you know, this will be a sign of continued cooperation and more normal, you know, scientific relationships.
For me, it's a great experience. I have 20 years of experience working in the sea, but never have I been able to go out from the border. It's like an empty page that we have to fill.
This is Michael Armenteros, an oceanographer at the University of Havana. He's leading the Cuban side of the collaboration. And for him, the work comes with a certain amount of urgency.
Mainly because we have really critical areas in Cuba that can be really damaged with the oil spill, like, for instance, hotels, marinas, big cities like Havana that is facing the Gulf of Mexico.
He says that any spill that reaches both the Cuban and the U.S. coastlines would devastate tourism, the economy, and marine life. And since both nations rely heavily on the Gulf's fisheries, it could impact an entire seafood industry.
You know, we share so many things.
Again, Steve Murawski.
It's very likely that Cuba is the source of a lot of the larvae for spiny lobsters, for example, that occur in the Florida Keys. Likewise, species like tarpon and bonefish that are very important to the fisheries of South Florida may have their origin in Cuba as well. And so that's why we're very interested in understanding the interrelationships, in particular between South Florida, the Cuban coast, and the Yucatan, which are all relatively close together.
As oil exploration grows in the Gulf, it'll be especially important to have international partnerships like this one. David Hollander says that working with experienced Cuban scientists makes it suddenly possible to dig into big questions from two sides at once.
I would say if we didn't have these kind of strong partnerships, the science would not be nearly as comprehensive as it is. I think this is vital to manage the Gulf of Mexico as a resource for all of us.
The team plans to continue these cruises throughout 2018. In the process, they're hoping this type of science diplomacy can bring all three Gulf nations closer together and help protect the marine ecosystem they all share. For Here and Now, I'm David Levin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.